Some history shows merely scratch the surface.
It's one small step for man.
We go a little deeper.
I regard myself as a soldier, though a soldier of peace.
This is Deep Into History. How deep do you want to go?
Deep Into History is independent and proudly listener-supported. Before we begin, I would like to thank my newest patron, who went to patreon.com/deepintohistory and pledged his support. James, my new historian, I salute you and thank you from the center of my being. Consider this a foreword. The next epic tale of the saga of how the Republic fell to the Empire versus Reforma is nearly complete. The delay in its release was because the script was becoming unwieldy, requiring constant rewrites, as I had to give context for everyone who had not experienced the Patreon Spotify exclusive versus The Curse of Apollo's Gold. To remedy this, I am re-releasing the teaser as part one, and what you are about to experience is part two, with the third part coming out next week. It will also give you a chance to give me feedback on the new production style of the show, as I hope to find the perfect formula as soon as possible. Please let me know what you think on Patreon, Spotify, or social media at Deep Into History on all platforms. I will take all of your comments and suggestions to heart and work with my producer to make it perfect for your ears. In addition, the full-length original version of Versus, The Curse of Apollo's Gold is available to all my subscribers right now and will remain so forever. If you have not listened to the first part, stop this now and do so. Trust me, you know I'll take you on an ancient trip like no one else can. Consider that as we go forward. And with that said, this forward comes to an end. This is Deep Into History. And I'm your host, Arjun Hundle. This is the tale of the Northern Frontier. A tale of the dark forest beyond the Alps where the fading light of the late Republic did not shine. The tale of a people who burst out of their ravaged homeland at the edge of the known world. Driven forward by a prophecy of a promised land, a new home, if they had the resolve to search for clues to its location, written on the entrails of their slain enemies. The saga of a Roman consul's greed that would bring down the wrath of a god on his homeland. Rome versus the Illyrians. Rome versus the Scordisci. Rome versus the Teutones. Rome versus the Cimbri. The Barbarian Wars. So take a deep breath, let it out slowly. Put some smoke in the air if you choose, and just let your mind flow to my voice as we go deep into the second century before the Common Era and experience the catastrophic Battle of Arausio in the epic prelude to the Cimbrian War versus the Curse of Apollo's Gold. Welcome back. Thus far in Versus, we have experienced the dirty wars fought by the late Republic through the career of Gaius Marius, the wars that don't ring out through history like those against Carthage or Macedonia. We were with him as he battled his way up the Cursus Honorum. In his long violent decade as a military tribune, he battled the tribes of southern Gaul. While he served in the Frontier Legion, guarding the constantly raided convoys on the lonely Roman road that connected Italy to Hispania, conquered the Isles of the Slingers in the legions of his Patronus, Cassellus Metellus Balearicus.
Excuse me, dude. You gotta say that again.
Cassellus Metellus Balearicus.
All right, Arjun. You can proceed.
Earned fame for his deeds battling the Celt-Iberians in the Numantine War, and in the process earning the love and respect of the legendary Roman general Scipio Aemilianus. He subdued the tribes of further Spain as overseer. And as we near the Jugurthine War, circa 110 before the Common Era, the war that would allow Marius to gain the consulship and conquer Numidia, what is so often forgotten is that total war had been raging in the east for decades. For all of Gaius Marius's long career, the conquered lands east of the Adriatic Sea, Epirus, Illyria, and Macedonia were under constant threat of invasion. These nascent provinces did not have the protection of the Alps as Italy did, and without that formidable natural barrier, they were directly exposed to hostile tribes, which meant constant raids by war bands of Celtic youth eager to earn honor in the eyes of their people, and many frequent full-scale invasions. The corrupt late Republic had not only taken these former kingdoms and the riches they had accumulated, but they also had inherited all of the problems of defending them as the original kingdoms had, In addition to all this, the locals were not fully Romanized. They yet felt the yearning for self-determination, the hope of freedom in their hearts, always whispers of rebellion echoing on the wind. Roman governors and regional overseers, nearly all optimates, the elite, were ruthlessly oppressive to the people of conquered lands. They had to be, because their goal was wealth extraction for themselves. The people were already burdened by high taxes collected by Roman tax farmers who had bought the right to collect them from the Senate for a set amount which served as a republic share.
Show me the money.
Their profit came from all they could take above that significant sum. One of their sources of significant profit was to sell peasants who could not pay their full taxes into slavery. Apart from a few kickbacks, none of this money went to the governors or overseers, so they sought every means at their disposal to extract every bit of wealth they could, forcing nobles to take loans for their tribes at usurious interest rates and seizing and then selling off their land if they defaulted on the debt. Just one of the ways Roman oppression was felt. Thus, fearing the righteous angers of the locals, most governors kept their legions close to the population centers and often left the frontiers poorly guarded. In the case of Macedonia and its huge northern border, recall that it was only the ultra-sophisticated and innovative network of small forts, interlinked and fully manned, that King Lysimachus and his son had fought and bled for decades to establish that finally secured their northern frontier. After the Roman conquest, no such system had been established, nor were the Romans willing to commit the resources and manpower to such a massive project. Consuls, governors, and praetors had short terms in office. There was no glory to be gained by simply securing a province from threats. The glory lay in battle. Victory, to show the Republic their virtues. Thus, most were looking to provoke a fight because conquering a tribe could bring the greatest honor of all, a triumph in Rome. It was in the era of which we were speaking, circa 120 BCE, that the Senate was forced to place a requirement that at least 5,000 enemies had to be killed in battle before a general could be eligible for one, as powerful families had been bribing and pressuring the Senate for triumphs for victories that amounted to no more than border skirmishes, or in some cases, village massacres. The sources for most of these wars are few, so I have reconstructed the events leading up to the Cimbrian War as best as I can, and synthesize them into a narrative timeline. A quick word about the geography. We'll be moving east from Italy, across the Adriatic Sea, through the conquered lands into Macedonia, then back west through central and northern Europe, across the top of the Italian Alps and into Gaul. During our journey, there will be many names, places, events, and dates, but you know I'll work them in ever so suavely, and every date is before the Common Era. So, let's go. In Illyria, north of Epirus, there were constant major military operations being conducted in the 130s to 120s that included both rebellions of local tribes and invasions by a large confederation of tribes, ethnically and culturally the same people, called the Dalmatians. The operations were so frequent and ongoing that this entire period is referred to as the Illyrian Wars. Then in 119, a huge rebellion, possibly timed in coordination with a full-scale invasion from the Dalmatians. This was such a catastrophe that both elected consuls were dispatched at the head of full consular armies, with two legions each and their companion alas, each force approaching 30,000 men. The consuls, one named Cotta and the other L. Caecilius Metellus.
Please rewind.
L. Caecilius Metellus.
The brother of the Metellus that would become Gaius Marius' nemesis during the Jugurthine War, campaigned together for a year, and Metellus remained behind with the legions for another to finish the campaign. Victorious, he was granted a triumph and given the title Dalmaticus. These wars were vital for the Republic because it was essential to keep the Adriatic free of piracy for trade, commerce, and the safety of travelers. The Romans forcibly relocated tribes away from the east coast who engaged in piracy, or even those suspected of it. Large and powerful tribes that refused to move were attacked. And over the decades, and the fact that Virtus demanded it, the Romans kept coming and coming, eventually wearing them down and defeating them. However, during the process, they suffered many major defeats. Far more details, though still relatively few, are known about the wars in and around the province of Macedonia, where Rome faced one of its most dangerous and implacable foes, a Celtic tribe known as the Scordisci. Their origins are murky, but according to some sources, the core of their tribe that was centered on the Danube River and dominated what is now modern Serbia, where the Celts that remained behind in Macedonia in 280 and served as mercenaries in the army of Pyrrhus of Epirus upon his return from his uniquely Pyrrhic defeat in his wars against Carthage and Rome. Returning with the remnants of his shattered army, perhaps 10,000, having achieved nothing but leaving in his wake the perfect set of circumstances to ensure that the First Punic War was inevitable, the warrior king took stock and weighed his options. He knew that the pretenders claiming the throne of Macedonia, his cousin Alexander's throne, were weak. They couldn't even take back the countryside from the Celts from Brennus' horde that stayed behind. Perhaps 30,000 warriors along with their families. A mix of small tribes who had taken up residence in the captured villages and farms of that land. Pyrrhus needed warriors, and he knew that if he had the savage Celtic veterans of the raid that destroyed Macedonia and plundered the oracle at Delphi on his side, and more importantly, under his command, he would take the throne. Cineas, the envoy, his only surviving close friend from what would become known as the Pyrrhic Wars, was dispatched to treat with them, and at a council of the Celtic chieftains, he made his king's offer. If they would serve the Eagle of Epirus on his epic quest to take what was by blood and proven valor rightfully his, the throne of Alexander the Great, he would give them a huge sum of gold. They would then have to move off so he could restore the countryside to his people, but they could call King Pyrrhus, the Eagle of the new Macedonian Empire, their friend and ally forevermore. The Celts agreed, sending 20,000 warriors. Combined with his veterans, his somewhat replenished heavy cavalry, and recall the 50 Indian war elephants, he now had a powerful army again. Pyrrhus drilled his new army into instruments of his will, and on the battlefield, used the Celtic charge combined with his own heavy cavalry charges like two sledgehammers. His elite veteran phalanx, along with new mercenaries, acting as the anvil, and simply vanquished all who stood against him, easily taking the throne. And true to his word, he paid the Celts what he owed and more. And true to their word, he returned to their families, gathered their stolen livestock, and moved north, out of Macedonia, and into the mists of history. But in this case, there are sources that say these now elite Celtic warriors, trained by Pyrrhus himself, laden with gold, decided to seize lands for themselves, and to achieve this, united into one tribe called the Scordisci. At first they wandered, and eventually came to the green and fertile Danube Valley and struck a claim to the lands around it. Any local tribes that took exception were crushed by these disciplined killing machines. Through their service, the Scordiscan way of making war had evolved. In very little time, every medium-sized tribe in the area that is now modern Serbia submitted to them, and through vast intermarriage became part of their extended tribe, which in turn allowed them to expand their power outward, because they could call on the Scordisci, who had taught them their new way of making war, organized Celtic fury. And thus, over the decades, their sphere of dominance kept extending and growing, with the Scordisci vanquishing any tribe that refused to submit to their new Celtic order so thoroughly that most simply submitted and joined, wishing to gain power rather than be made an example of. Others became client tribes that paid tribute and could be called upon to provide warriors to fight for the Scordisci at any time. Their power eventually enveloped the Dardani. Recall that the king of Dardania was forced to join Brennus' horde after the usurper Serranus foolishly rejected his offer of alliance, bringing the Scordisci's power and influence to the northern border of Macedonia, which had become a Roman province in 148, after the legions of Quintus Metellus Macedonicus, the patronus of Gaius Marius's father, crushed the armies of the last king of Macedon, Perseus, and paraded him through the streets of Rome in his triumph, bound in chains made from his own gold. Being hyper-expansionist and seeing weakness in that the Romans had neglected to secure the frontier, the Scordisci assembled a warband and launched a massive raid on the province. The details are very few, but in 141, the Scordisci destroyed the Roman legions of Macedonia utterly. But the Romans, driven by Vertus, kept coming, so that by 135, the Romans had restored their province and were campaigning north beyond the frontier and inflicted a huge defeat on the Scordisci. It took place beyond the northern frontier and must have been a battle of considerable size with equally considerable casualties. because the Skordisky and their allies needed to take the time to replenish their ranks, to raise and train a new generation of warriors. And as such, there appears to have been relative peace along the border until the year 120. Then, in 119, the Skordisky invaded in force. The governor of Macedonia, a praetor named Sextus Pompeius, a relative of the as-yet-unborn Pompey Magnus, led his legions out to confront the Celtic horde, but was killed in battle and his legions scattered. His quaestor, one M. Annius, rallied the legions after their battle line broke when the news of their praetor had fallen, spread panic, and led them on to defeat the Skordisky utterly. The next day, he led his victorious, though battered men in pursuit of the survivors, following them into lands dominated by their power beyond the frontier. The survivors were met and reinforced by an allied Thracian tribe called the Medi, and turned to face the Romans, only to be defeated again. The next few years are murky. There are fragments that suggest one consul fought a series of campaigns. For context, for one of the two chief instruments of Roman military power leading a consular army to be at war for 2 years within Macedonia suggests a major invasion by the Skordisky, and at least hints that revolt may have been a major concern. In 114, the consul Gaius Porcius Cato was leading his legions through the Servian mountains, perhaps on a punitive expedition, and was ambushed by the Skordisky. The surprise was total, and the trap so expertly executed that only the consul and a few of the cavalry managed to get away. The Skordisky had wiped out nearly all Roman power in the region, and they fell upon Macedonia like a hurricane, blowing through any defense, and following in the footsteps of Brennus and their ancestors, they went straight south to Greece and sacked the temple of Apollo at Delphi. When the defeated consul Cato returned to Rome with news of the disaster, he was prosecuted in the Senate, forever stripped of dignitas, and made an outcast because Virtus demanded it. There was lamentation in the streets of Rome. Many families had lost loved ones in the huge consular army that was destroyed, which turned to panic when they heard of the sack of the Oracle of Apollo. To atone for their failure to protect Apollo's oracle, the Romans performed a human sacrifice, ritualistically burying alive two Greek and two Celtic slaves in the Forum Romanum. However, unbeknownst to them, a Roman commander named Didius had rallied the local forces of Macedonia and was defeating war bands that had separated away from the main force, perhaps laden with treasure, more likely because their homeland was suffering a massive incursion from a Germanic tribe, the Cimbri. All warriors were needed immediately. So the Skordisky moved off, giving Didius the time to secure the province until reinforcements from Rome could arrive. Both consuls for the following year, 113, were sent to face these threats from the north. The first, Consul Gnaeus Papirius Carbo, marched at the head of a consular army up through Italy to the northeast Alps to answer a desperate plea for aid from an important allied tribe, the Noriki, whose scouts reported that a huge migration of people was coming directly toward their land, which lay just beyond the mountain range. The second, Consul C. Caecilius Metellus, uncle of the nemesis of Gaius Marius, was tasked with leading his legions to punish the Skordisky for their terrible raid and to secure the frontier of the province once and for all. His legions crossed the Adriatic, and it appears he did march into Thrace at least partially, but no major battle was fought. Yet he was awarded a triumph by the Senate because his ultra-powerful family bought him one. The consul of the following year was again sent to the region, and Livius Drusus unleashed his legions on the north, driving away nearly every small tribe anywhere near their borders. Some accounts have Drusus as the first Roman consul to reach the Danube River. I don't think this is likely, but his incursion was deep and effective in a punitive sense. It also hints that the Skordisky had paid a heavy price in lives, or at least their manpower was strained in order to repulse the Cimbri. We'll turn to the Cimbric migration in a little while. For now, let's stay in Macedonia. Low-level fighting continued for the next 2 years, most likely small raiding parties that would then be pursued by the legions back beyond the border. Finally, the Senate resolved to wage a protracted war on and beyond the frontier of Macedon and end the threat.
so that the province could finally become peaceful, its population Romanized, and maximize profitability. So in 110, with war raging in Numidia and chaos on the northern frontier, one of the consuls, Marcus Minucius Rufus, with the full backing of the tribunes of the plebs and the Senate, was granted proconsular imperium, meaning he was to campaign until he crushed the Scordisci and secured the province and Greece beyond once and for all. Again, the details are few, but I've pieced together as much of the story of his campaign as I can. He definitely led a full consular army, so two legions and their companion Ali, and would have command of the single legion stationed in Macedonia, very roughly putting his total strength at 35,000. However, Macedonia could not be left undefended. So let's assume the force he led against the Scordisci was again very roughly 25,000. I give this context because we have no numbers for the enemy forces he faced. Consul Minucius wasted no time and took the offense immediately, apparently first moving to the northeast of Macedonia and ravaging the lands of the Medi, who were a powerful tribe allied to the Scordisci. Then he moved west into the lands of the Scordisci proper, burning every abandoned village and farmstead they came across. Everywhere the legions moved, they found ghost towns, empty villages, silence. As it turned out, the Scordisci and the Medi had moved their people to the land of the Dacians and had united their forces and approached the Roman legions as they were about to cross the frozen river Hebrus in modern Bulgaria. The terrain all around, a range of wooded hills. The legions were marching, snaking their way through a valley, when his scouts returned with the news that they were about to face a huge barbarian force that would be on the legions in minutes. Consul Minucius, massively outnumbered and with an ordered withdrawal impossible, called his legions to battle formation.
Form a line and stand strong!
And made an epic roll of the dice. He dispatched his brother, who was a cavalry officer, with a small squadron and all of his trumpeters and signalers around another path in the hills, so that once battle was joined, they would be behind the approaching enemy army. They were to stay out of sight, hidden, waiting, and when battle began in earnest, the trumpets were to sound, and the cavalry squadron was to appear at the front of the path so that to the enemy, it would look and sound like the lead element of an entire other Roman army. The late Republic's Battle of Ice took place on the frozen river Hebrus. The manipular legions arrayed in the quincax, the famous checkerboard formation, their skirmishers already retreating after peppering their foes with their javelins through the gaps in the line so that the Hastadii could close their lines and launch their pilum before engaging in total war. The Romans endured the initial charge on the slippery ice, but quickly had to retreat behind the heavy infantry, the princeps. The fighting was fierce, and the Scordisci numbers were beginning to swing the battle their way. Now was the time. The consul's brother ordered the trumpets to be blown. Which he had spread throughout the valley down which he and the cavalry had ridden. The effect sent a vast echoing symphony coming from the trail. And when the Scordisci saw the squadron of cavalry riding in formation, they assumed that this was a Roman trap. Another army was about to assault them in their rear, and they began a panicked retreat on the slippery ice. The Romans pursued them mercilessly, at the cost of much of the cavalry, which fell into the frigid waters of the river. When the ice broke under the hooves of their mounts, while riding down their fleeing targets, the legions slaughtered the armies of both tribes. A victory so massive and a defeat inflicted on such a scale that the Scordisci would not be a threat for years. And weakened by the loss of so many warriors, they were vulnerable to the tribes around them. If they were to survive at all, they would need time to regroup and allow their boys to grow into a new generation of warriors. News of this victory was celebrated in Rome. Vertus had finally been satisfied, and when news reached the Senate that his legions had proclaimed him Imperator, they unanimously voted him the honor of a triumph upon his return to Rome. Then in a gesture of gratitude to the consul, the guardians of the temple at Apollo at Delphi honored him with an equestrian statue with the inscription,
Marcus Minucius, son of Quintus Rufus, imperator after the Gauls, Scordisci, Bessi, Thracians, because of his merits, was dedicated by the people of Delphi. He celebrated his triumph in 106 before the Common Era, the year of prophecy, when Gaius Marius, upon his triumphant return after his victory in the Jugurthine War, was informed that in his absence the people had demanded that he be made consul for a second time, breaking the rule set by the Cursus Honorum, because they needed the Achilles of the late Republic to save them from the Cimbrian Teutones rampaging just beyond the Alps. At that moment, Gaius Marius knew the prophecy he had received as a boy was true. He was Jupiter's chosen, and he would fulfill his destiny and become consul 7 times, no matter the cost. Now, you may be wondering why the Senate and people of Rome were in such an utter state of panic, an utter state of fear, that they would break all laws, all rules, all norms, and set such a dangerous precedent of allowing the same man to have so much power in such a short time frame. Well, the setup to the setup of the Cimbrian War goes like this. Bursting out of the north beyond the edge of the known world came a human tidal wave. Their homeland, consisting of modern Denmark, southern Norway, and Sweden, along with a short strip of coastline along the Baltic, had suffered 7 years of flooding from the sea, leaving their homeland destroyed, their crop yields plummeted, and their livestock died out. There was mass starvation, the effects of which can be seen in the stunted growth of skeletons found from this period in Denmark. The High King of the Cimbri, Boiorix, went to the Druids to seek their wisdom and to ask them to ask their gods what they should do. So far, every sacrifice made to them had failed to bring relief. They were not Celts, but rather the first Germanic tribe to make a major incursion into Central and Southern Europe, speaking a different language and with very different traditions and beliefs. Firstly, all of their Druids, the conduit to their gods and the lorekeepers of their people, were women, wearing long flowing white robes and always walking barefoot. Few exact details about them are known, except that they were held in the highest esteem and were very powerful in their society. They were skilled diviners and blood readers who practiced human sacrifice with, according to the Romans, sadistic glee, who called them witches after tales of what befell enemies captured by them endured during the last few moments of their life. At their High King's behest, the witches of the Cimbri communed with their gods and brought forth a prophecy of a promised land. The 7 years of death and despair would continue because the gods had declared it was time for the Cimbri to move on and to leave their ancestral lands. King Boiorix asked where this promised land was to be found. They pointed south and informed him that they would find clues to its exact location along the way, left by the gods in the blood and entrails of the enemies they were sure to meet on their journey. The king considered the monumental task of moving his entire people, with the Druids, who would soon be preaching the prophecy to all, the peasants not wishing to offend the gods and having suffered through what they perceived as 7 years of their displeasure would be willing. His nobles and chieftains would need convincing, as they would be giving up vast landholdings. Whether King Boiorix himself believed in the prophecy or not, he was already convinced of the necessity to lead his suffering people to a rich new land. He called for a council of all his chieftains and the kings of their large neighboring tribes, both Germanic as well, the Teutones and Umbrones. When they met, Boiorix informed them of the prophecy and spoke of the reality that their lands were dying, their people starving and withering away from malnutrition. Seeing the wisdom in his words, they took vows of alliance and agreed that they would all migrate. They would seek out new lands and help each other in taking them. Thus, circa 125 before the Common Era, the massive exodus began. The Cimbri, the far more numerous and strongest of the tribes, took time organizing their starving but mighty people into a living caravan that would allow their society to continue while on their perilous quest. Families constructed large carts with leather coverings that would serve as their home until their promised land was found. These ancient mobile homes possibly had 2 stories, with a bedroom, sitting area, and even room for their dogs. For context, the Celts, who were masters at the craft of constructing these kinds of carts, were in wonder at their size and ingenious construction. The Cimbri were also a striking people, larger in stature than the Celts, who themselves dwarf most Romans. The historian Theodore Mommsen's words from The History of Rome, Book 4.
The Revolution. The men of the south beheld with astonishment those tall, lank figures, with fair locks and bright blue eyes. Their hardy and stately women, who were hardly inferior in size or strength to their men. And the children, with hair of old men, referring to their silvery blonde locks.
Imagine the scale of moving over 250,000 people, warriors with their entire families, old and young, with all their belongings, livestock, and all their society held sacred, moving into the literal unknown world, knowing nothing about what awaited them, apart from the mysterious enemies they would have to slay to find clues that would lead them to their promised land. A perilous quest, to say the least. But these Germanic people had faith in their gods and their leaders, and were warriors to their core, as all of Europe was about to discover. The Cimbri themselves differed from the Celtic tribes as warriors in a few ways. They were all armored in chainmail and wore copper helmets, heavy infantry, who wielded a heavy longsword and a narrow but lengthy rectangular shield that they held side on so they could slash with their free sword arm. In addition, each warrior carried a strange and unknown type of missile weapon called a metaurus. This is just an educated guess. I think them most likely to be some kind of throwing spear that the Cimbri used to repel cavalry charges, or in ambush situations, as there is no record of them throwing them before contact with the enemy, as the Roman legions did with their pilum. The sword belts they wore had a circular loop hanging in front through which, in battle, they would run a long chain down the entire length of their front line, literally connecting every warrior together.
Ouch!
It is possible that this was used to keep the charging army in a straight line so that the impact was felt all at once, and the awesome power of the Cimbric charge was about to become legendary. The Teutones and Imbrones appear to have been very closely linked and possibly related, and as their lands were on coastal Germany, they began the migration first, soon followed by the Cimbri. They appear to have been more wild and aggressive in combat, not necessarily undisciplined, but not matching the Cimbri. These three Germanic tribes were an honor culture, and it is recorded that on many occasions after negotiations failed and war was declared, they would arrange in advance to meet their enemy on a set day on a set battlefield, either fighting a full-scale battle or often the issue being settled by single combat by champions chosen by each side between the armies. Their word was their bond, so they abided by the outcome of these duels to settle whatever the dispute was. As the tribes moved south into the area of central modern Germany, the Celts became panicked at the incursion of their lands by such a vast multitude of people. Not Celts, but Germanic. Others. The first large Celtic tribe they encountered were the Boii, who launched relentless attacks on them, trying to drive them off their lands. Over the course of years, they moved south to the Danube and began to follow it east, which led them into a direct battle with the Scordisci in 113, as I mentioned earlier. The very few historical fragments are divided as to who won. But since the Cimbri began moving west towards Italy afterwards, I believe it is safe to assume that no matter the outcome of the confrontation, the Cimbri were repulsed. Or perhaps their druids read the blood and entrails of their enemies and declared that their promised land lay in the west. It also appears that the Teutones and Imbrones had separated from the Cimbri because during that year, they were already moving west and quickly approaching the Italian Alps. Months before, the Senate had received a plea for aid against a barbarian horde that was headed directly for them from an allied tribe. These were the Taurisci, who dwelt in the lands immediately on the other side of the northeastern edge of the mountains beyond Italy. Over the decades, Rome had made many such alliances so that the tribes would serve as buffers and an early warning system of large-scale invasions.
These alliances were a mixed bag for the tribes that accepted them. They did get the benefit of telling potential enemies that they were allies of the respected, if not feared, Republic of Rome, and that their legions would come to their aid. Often, the Romans did not honor their alliances, or did so half-heartedly, sending moral support rather than legions. The greatest benefit for allied tribes was access for their goods and raw materials to be sold through trade with the Republic, which brought them great wealth. In this case, the Tarisci, whose country, Noriki, called Noricum by the Romans, had to be saved. For their iron mines and the vast quantities they sold directly to Rome were vital. Without that supply, the Romans would have a massive shortfall, with potentially catastrophic ramifications, as Rome could not make war without it. This, coupled with a deep-rooted fear of another Celtic king like Brennus, leading a huge horde of barbarians and destroying Italy before sacking and burning the Eternal City, settled the issue. Thus, the consul Gnaeus Papirius Carbo was dispatched at the head of a consular army to investigate, and a mandate to protect their allies, their iron and gold mines, and at all costs prevent a barbarian incursion into Italy. We can see the fear of an invasion, as his first act once he reached the north was not to go directly to Noricum, but instead he fortified the passes through the Alps, and his army took up a defensive position there. Despite repeated pleas and warnings, only when he received word that the barbarians were about to cross the borders of Noricum did he move to the Tarisci's aid. As his legions marched, they were approached by ambassadors from the Teutones, who apologized for crossing into Noricum. They said that they came in peace, only wished to move onwards, and that they had no wish to quarrel with Rome. Consul Carbo perhaps did not believe the Teutones' intentions, or just as likely, a consul who badly wished a military victory so that he could be granted a triumph upon his victorious return to Rome. Fame eternal. Either way, treachery was afoot. He agreed to let them pass and sent them guides to lead them through and past Noricum. Taking him at his word, the ambassadors thanked him and departed without ever suspecting that Carbo had instructed the guides to lead the Teutones on a long route so that his legions could get ahead of them and set an ambush to destroy the barbarians. It took place near the town of Noreia in Noricum. Frustratingly few details are known about the Battle of Noreia, except that the ambushers became the ambushed. It appears that Carbo had no idea of just how vast and fierce the host of Teutones was. For shortly after the trap was sprung, the legions found themselves completely overwhelmed and were crushed, with legionaries running away into the woods, only to find that they'd been enveloped by Teutone warriors, a consular army annihilated. We can learn a lot about the reaction in Italy, as the phrase Führer Teutonicus was on everyone's lips. It describes the fear of the savage and unworldly fury of the Teutones in battle. When word of this crushing defeat of the Romans spread across Celtic Europe and reached the area of modern Switzerland, the country of the Helvetii, a confederation of tribes, the news was taken very differently. They sought news of these mighty strangers and heard tales of their epic quest to find their promised land, and it inspired something in the people. For a mere generation later, they would follow the Cimbri example, and they too would leave their poor lands to seek a new fertile homeland. A vast migration that was doomed, as they would be Julius Caesar's first target in what would become the Gallic Wars. But that is a tale for another day. However, immediately after the Battle of Noreia, there were two Helvetic tribes that decided that this meant that the Romans were weak, and that it was open season on any of the cowardly tribes that had allied themselves to the Republic. Thus the Tigurini and Toigeni assembled a war band and planned their raid. All the while, the Germanic migration continued, following the Alps directly into southern Gaul, an area full of tribes allied to Rome. In 109, Consul Metellus, along with his legate Gaius Marius, assembled badly needed reinforcements before setting off to take command in Numidia and destroy Jugurtha. The other consul elected that year, Marcus Junius Solanus, was given a mandate of protecting the province of Gallia Narbonensis and the allied tribes in southern Gaul as the Cimbri had reached their borders. And almost as soon as he was on station with his legions, in his first clash with the Cimbri, was completely wiped out. There are no details of the battle itself, but in the aftermath, the Cimbri sent a message to the Senate,
stating that honor demanded that the people of Mars, the Romans, should give them land by way of pay and use their hands and weapons for any purpose they wish. An offer of peace, alliance, and possible future cultural integration from a migrating people. This phenomenon would be repeated over and over in the coming centuries, eventually playing a major factor in the fall of the Roman Empire. The Senate rejected this offer immediately. After Noreia and this second major defeat, Vertus demanded that Rome not make a treaty from a position of weakness. And above all, there was a very real fear that if they accepted, all their enemies, allied tribes, and even the subjects in the provinces would revolt, sparking a republic-wide series of invasions and rebellions that would destroy Rome. So instead, the Romans did what they always did. They kept coming. For the year 108, there is a complete blackout as to the military campaigns in the north. However, both consuls elected that year were removed from power for corruption and bribery used to attain the office. So blatant that even in the context of the vast public bribery on display for every citizen to see during the ongoing Jugurthine War, it made that corruption look tame in comparison. An insight to the level of public rage after Jugurtha pulled off the facade and showed the complete and utter corruption at every level of Roman society. In the election of 107 that we experienced in the Eagles of Jupiter, Gaius Marius won his first consulship. The other consul elected that year, one Cassius Longinus, was dispatched to restore order in Gaul. He arrived in the Roman province beyond the Alps, only to find that the Cimbri had vanished, moved on, and no one seemed to know where or why. It made no sense. For all intents and purposes, they had control of much of the rich and fertile land of southern Gaul. And after the battle in 109, Italy had lain completely open to an incursion. Why had they left? This baffled the Romans. But with hindsight, we can understand that the Druids had read the signs, and their gods told them that the path to their promised land led elsewhere. Consul Longinus had no shortage of enemies. Recall the Tigurinian Toigini warband that sought the Cimbri. They had arrived and were wreaking havoc across Gaul. Longinus's legions followed the Tigurini warband across the length of the country, all the way to the Atlantic Ocean, only to find that they had slipped away. On the way back to the province, his legions were ambushed by the Tigurini and Toigeni and were badly defeated. The consul and one of his legates were killed, along with what appears to be the better part of his army. The survivors rallied to their only surviving commander, a legate at their camp, and were soon surrounded. In exchange for their lives, they had to give up half of their baggage, weapons, and hand over hostages to the Tigurini. It was a hopeless situation, and the legate did all he could to save his men so that they could live to fight another day. However, upon his return to Rome, he was brought up on charges for the infamy of giving Roman hostages to barbarians and was forced into exile. With war raging on two fronts, in the brutal Jugurthine War in Africa and the constant defeats along the northern frontier had the population in Italy in a near state of panic. And with all the light shed on the corruption, the rot that was killing the Republic laid bare for all to see, it seemed that the very fabric of Roman society was coming apart. The effect of these defeats on the Celts in Gaul was dramatic. Allied tribes turned neutral or openly hostile. And in Gallia Narbonensis, the Tectosages revolted. Their main town, Tolosa, modern Toulouse, in the north of the province, overcame the Roman garrison and clasped them in chains to quell the fear, terror, and lamentation at the huge loss of life. The Senate resolved to assemble the largest Roman army since the time of Hannibal for a titanic confrontation to wipe out the Cimbri and Totones once and for all. And we'll experience the epic battle of Arausio the next time we go deep. Thank you for listening to Deep Into History. Please tell everyone you know about the show. You can follow me at Deep Into History on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky, and TikTok. Deep Into History is produced by York Campbell from Poetic Earthling Studio. And the introduction is performed by Shante at ctamarketing.biz. And as always, my dear sweet friend, take care of yourself. I truly look forward to the next time we go deep.
How deep do you want to go?